I hope we're all thankful for the privilege of assembling together on this beautiful morning to worship the Lord. We're appreciative of the song service, the prayer that's been offered. We ask that you continue to try to pray in the time that we're gathered together. And first of all, I don't have the faintest idea what my hat was being up here, doing up here. Last memory I had of it, it was in the third seat of Elder Lawrence's vehicle. And I just bring it in case it's supposed to rain or I've got to spend a lot of time in the sun. Maybe somebody brought it in with the lunch or such as that. But at any rate, I thought I might ought to remove it. It might get more attention than I'm going to get. But on the other hand, maybe I need to wear it because I'll do anything to get attention. It's useless to preach to people if you do not have their attention. But with that off my mind, and also appreciate the brethren closing these doors. I learned long years ago, I can preach or talk all day in a hot place or a cold place, but I do not want to deal with a draft. And apparently I'm not the only old maid in the building. Some of you folks said last night the draft was getting to you. But with that out of the way, I want to go immediately to what's on my mind. When we come to the 59th Psalm, you'll notice right under the 59th Psalm, if you have a good King James Reference Bible, and if not, I can show you in the ragged one I've carried in my pocket for years. Right under Psalms 59, you're going to find some things there in very fine print that are going to say to the chief musician, and it'll name him, but it'll also tell you that this psalm was written during that time that Saul sent messengers to watch David's house and to kill him in the morning. Those titles and those psalms that are in fine print were not put there by the King James translators or any other translators. They're part of the original Hebrew Masoretic text. And sometimes it pays attention, sometimes it's wise to pay attention to those titles because those titles are going to give you some idea of the circumstances under which this particular psalm was written. And I've learned a long time ago that in any Bible lesson, it's very important to pay attention to the context. This psalm, which the title tells us, was written because of a time when Saul had sent messengers to watch David's house and to kill him in the morning. It refers to some times that you'll find explained more fully in your Bible in 1 Samuel chapters 19 and 20. When you read those chapters, you find over there that Saul had an intense hatred or jealousy of young David. And Saul's son Jonathan was a very close friend to David. And in fact, their friendship was so close that even today, whenever people are very close, it's a proverb to say they're as close as David and Jonathan. And we read in there of a time when Jonathan goes to his father Saul and tries to point out David's good points to soften Saul's attitude toward David. But Saul softens for a while, but he reneges. His jealous bad nature comes out, and he throws a javelin at David, tries to kill him. But in 1 Samuel chapter 19, verse 11, we read of a time when David is in his home with his wife, Saul's daughter. And the Bible tells us that Saul instructs men to watch that house all night long, and they're supposed to kill David when he comes out in the morning. Now, it's very important to set this back in a context. David has no cell phones. He has no communication to the outside world. David cannot call 911, cannot get on his phone or cell phone. He has no way to contact any help. David knows he's in danger. He has no place to turn for help but to the Lord. This helps us understand the first statement in the psalm where he says, "Deliver me from mine enemies, O Lord," says, "Defend me from those that rise up against me." You'll also find elsewhere in that psalm where David cries out for someone to defend him and someone to deliver him. Then when you come to the end of that psalm, you'll find there where David is saying to the Lord that I will sing of thy mercy. He says, I will sing aloud of thy praise in the morning. He praises God because God has been his defense and his refuge in time of trouble. That this becomes more than poetry to us when we understand that if Saul had been able to carry his plans out, that David would not even have been alive in the morning, much less able to sing of God's mercy and sing aloud of God's power in the morning. You can go back to 1 Samuel chapter 19, begin at verse 11, and you can read of the arrangements the Lord made over there to deliver David and for David to escape. But I also go back one more time and emphasize that when you read the conclusion of that psalm where David is saying that I will sing of thy mercy, I will sing aloud of thy power in the morning, that David would not have been able to do this if God had not come to his aid and arranged to defend and deliver him, because if Saul had carried out his plan, David would have been dead in the morning. In the end of that psalm, he's praising God for several things, but he's praising God because God has been his defender. He's been his refuge in time of trouble. If it's the Lord's will, I want to try to point out this morning that as we go through this life, there's many times in which we need to be defended also. We not only need a defense, but we'll find, if the Lord will allow me to free course of what's on my mind and unload what's on my mind, that not only are we here today because we've had defenders in the past that we might not even be aware of, but we also have a responsibility, we have an obligation to the Lord to defend some things ourselves. There's some things in the Bible that the Bible teaches us that God's people have a responsibility to stand in defense of those particular things. And I suppose next to studying the Bible, the subjects in life that I've studied the most have first of all been history of all kinds, especially military history. And I suppose the only other subject might rival my study of history, and especially military history, would be a lifetime interest I've had in the human body and ways to keep it healthy, and my study of diet and nutrition and reflexology and chiropractic and natural means of healing. And I suppose, though, in addition to the Bible, I probably spent more time studying those two other subjects than any other two subjects. In being fascinated all my life with military history, I've learned to admire men in the past that have defended our country, and other people through the past that have rose to the defense of other nations. I have learned not only to defend outstanding military leaders, men such as George S. Patton and Douglas MacArthur and Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson and Jeb Stuart. Now, I don't want to name too many of my heroes of the past, because you might think that I have a biased attitude toward the war of Northern aggression, which some people call the Civil War. I refuse to call it that. If I name too many of my heroes and put in there Nathan Bedford Forrest and Jeb Stuart, Stonewall Jackson and Robert E. Lee, you might get the idea I'm a bit biased when it comes to the war of Northern aggression that our people fought here about over 140 some odd years ago. But be that as it may, I've learned not only to admire the military leaders, generals, and folk like that I could name, but I also have a great admiration for the men down in the trenches. I've read of some heroic acts performed by ordinary foot soldiers, just ordinary men that were on the battleships, men we would call of low rank, but I know some of their stories also. So I have developed a great admiration for men of the lowest rank on up to the highest generals that have risen to the defense of our country in the past, and also men that have risen to the defense of other peoples in the past. One of my great Bible heroes, of course, is Joshua. And so I could talk to you a long time about great acts of defense, or great defenders that I've known along that line. But as I think about defenders, I also have in my head a very large collection of stories and accounts that I've heard of about dogs and faithful pets that have defended their masters. It's been said over the years that a dog is man's best friend. And after I was badly injured back in the past, trying to do a good deed, trying to help about a 1,000-pound Brangus mama cow who was having trouble delivering a calf, I was trying to do a good deed, but sometimes I look back in life and I come to the conclusion that my good deeds seldom go unpunished. Maybe some of you may know what I mean by that. Sometimes you're trying to do a good deed and it just sort of blows up your face. But after the word went out, I invested in with various brethren over the country, and some of them I'd known for 20 years. They began to tell me a lot of their cow and bull stories. And my first thought that went through my mind, is there an epidemic of these things over the country? Then I thought about it a little more, and there's a great spiritual point here. There was one brother, for instance, up in the mountains that I had baptized him and his wife about 21 years ago when preaching for a church had no pastor at that time. I'd had a meal in his home every year. I'd been around him every year for about 21 years. And after he had heard I'd been injured by an animal, he said, "Why, Brother Sonny, I've been beaten up by those old cows many times. I've gone around stove up for months." And he starts telling me some of his cow and bull stories. Now, there was not an epidemic of those things going on. These things been happening all along, but people had no reason to believe that I would be interested in these things. If I'm making this story halfway clear, here's a man, I'd been in his company every year for about 20-some-odd years. He'd never talked to me about any of his experiences, but he found out I had had a common experience. And now he's ready to talk to me about his experience. The spiritual lesson in that is that the only people you're going to find in this world that are interested in your spiritual experiences are people who've had a common experience. And I can tell from looks on your faces, some of you done figured that out. You can start trying to talk about your spiritual experiences to people who have not had a common experience and they have no interest in it. 1 Corinthians 2:14 says, "The natural man receiveth not the things of the Spirit of God, neither indeed can he know them. They're foolishness unto him, for they're spiritually discerned." And the only people that are going to be interested in your spiritual experiences are people that have had a similar experience. And I began to realize that there's not an epidemic of animal injuries over this country. A lot of these people, when I came through, they had no reason to believe I'd be interested in their stories till they found out I had a similar experience. I was in the home last year of a Primitive Baptist deacon in Mississippi. I'd known him for many, many years. And because he knew I'd had an experience with animals, he began to tell me that on the farm he was raised on in Mississippi, there was a baby bull Jersey calf that was born. Now, if you folks here know anything about livestock, dairy bulls are among the most dangerous of all. And a Jersey is one of the meanest of the dairy bulls. And more dangerous on average than beef bulls. But this baby Jersey bull calf was born on the farm. They raised it up like a pet. And in dealing with it all the time, they sort of forgot this nature. And in the next few minutes, some of the things I'm going to bring up, somebody might think, "Well, this doesn't sound like preaching." But maybe if some of you youngsters or maybe some of you oldsters will listen to me, you might find out a little bit later that this dog you played with all the time has a change in nature when she has pups. And this cat you've roughed up and played with all the time, they're still an animal. And maybe what I say this morning might prevent some person in this congregation, some youngster, from getting injured sometime down in the future if you'll listen to me. Over a period of time, these folk sort of forgot that they were dealing with a Jersey bull. Baby born on the farm, been brought up as a pet. So there came a time when this man's dad looked down and this big Jersey bull, which was grown, had gotten tangled up in the barbed wire fence. So dad goes down there and he's carrying a spool of rusty barbed wire because he's quite confident that he's going to have to take a little piece of this roll of barbed wire and repair the fence. Dad goes down there, spreads the fence. The big bull will not back up. So dad comes over and swats the old family pet on the head. The bull backed up. Dad gets busy, starts trying to repair the fence. The nature of that Jersey bull comes out, and that Jersey bull charged him, knocked him down, and would have mauled him, and the boys start picking up rocks and everything they can find, throwing it at the bull, yelling at the bull, but the bull will not stop. The bull intends to maul their daddy, probably beat him to death. There were two dogs that the family owned. These dogs ran up, began to nip at the bull, charged the bull and all this. The bull backed off, went away with the dogs chasing. I've known of some very heroic stories about dogs being defenders, rising to the defense of their masters. Another quick one I want to tell you. I don't know back here in civilized Tennessee if you're dealing with home invasions, but in Dallas not too long ago, there's a woman about 77 years old. Here's a knock at the door, the ring of the doorbell, and she had an iron door bar across the door, such things as like I've welded up and put on my doors at home. She goes to the door and she removes this iron door bar. Just soon she opens the door, there's two fellas standing there ready. They're about to commit a home invasion. You open the door, they overpower you. Soon she opens the door, one of those fellas shot her right in the face with some orange pepper spray, and they're intending to charge in, do a home invasion, and she had a small dog. This dog leaps at those two men and starts trying to bite them and attack them. Very tiny dog. They become concerned with the dog, start trying to want them to bury the dog with orange pepper spray. The little lady recovers enough to grab the iron door bar, and she starts beating the daylights out of them with it and hobbled them up enough. The police came along and caught them. And when it was all over with, she said, the main thing about that makes me mad was the long cleanup job she had to do on a little dog. There's no telling what would happen to that lady if that little dog hadn't been there to defend her. And maybe a lot of you folk out here have had experiences like this where dogs have risen to the defense of their masters. It's an old, old story and an old saying that a good dog can be a man or a person's very best friend. I've also noticed over the years that I've heard a lot of experiences, collected a lot of accounts where mothers, females of all kinds, have risen to the defense of their young. And the warning I want to put out here to everybody in this congregation, perhaps to especially to youngsters in this congregation, this cat you have at home that you've played with and mauled all these years has a change in her nature when she bears kittens. You're also going to find maybe a dog you've roughhoused has a change in nature when that mama bears pups. Things also happen to cows, and I'm going to prove in a minute that God has put a defense instinct in females of all kinds to be very protective of their young. Females of all kinds, according to nature, are very protective of their young. I come over to 2 Timothy chapter 3, and the Apostle Paul begins there by saying, this know also, that in the last days perilous times shall come. And in my lifetime, I've counted there about 21 signs of the last days. And maybe you're a closer Bible reader than I am. You might find 22 or 23. Now, some objector might say, well, Brother Powell, some of this has been around the foundation of the world. I think I know that. But I challenge anyone to name me a time in history when all 21 of these signs were flashing at the same time. You might find some time back in the past where some of these things were around, but in the day and age in which we're living, all 21 of these signs here flashing at the same time. He says, this know also that in the last days perilous times shall come. He said, men shall be lovers of their own selves. I want to give you a clue right here. Self-love is the root cause of everything that's going to follow on this list. He said, in the last days, men should be lovers of their own selves. And I've noticed a lot today, in this day and age, when I wander through bookstores and magazine racks, there's a lot of emphasis in this world today on self. Here's all kinds of books on how to get to know yourself, how to live with yourself. There's even a magazine called Self. All kinds of books there on self-improvement. A lot of emphasis today on self. When I go to the Bible, the Lord tells me instead that I'm supposed to deny myself. He tells me that this is a life of self-denial, but all this emphasis today on self is producing a lot of self-loving, very selfish people. He says, this know also that in the last days, men should be lovers of their own selves, says they'll be covetous. What's the main problem that a covetous person has? It's self-concern, self-love, boasters. I don't have to figure out what a boaster's main problem is, self. That be covetous, boasters, proud. What's a proud person's main problem? Too much concern about self. Covetous, boasters, proud, disobedient to parents, but here's the one I'm racing toward. One of the signs of the last days is that people will be without natural affection. I realize that term without natural affection can be applied to some of these odd people out here in our society. And you can read about those odd people in Romans chapter 1, especially verses 27 and 28. He says there come a time here that men would leave the natural use of the woman. They'd do that which is against nature. Catch this. He also says there that even their women would begin to burn in their lust toward one another. And he tells us here that also they'd be doing that which is against nature. He says, for this cause God gave them over to a reprobate mind. Look in the center column. That word reprobate means void of judgment. There are a lot of people in this world today just totally void of judgment. That just means they're lacking common sense. And what's been called common sense all my life is so lacking in our world today, I'm about ready to start calling it uncommon sense. Now, I grant that this term here, without natural affection, includes some of these things I've tried to speak about very discreetly because I realize I'm preaching in the presence of women and children, and I don't really enjoy talking about these things to the brethren, but read those verses, and you can figure out a lot more than I've said already. I have said twice this morning that this term without natural affection includes this, but it's not limited to that. It goes beyond that. When I look at this term here that says that people will be without natural affection, that also includes something that God has put into females of every kind. According to nature, God puts a defense mechanism into females of every kind that when they become young, when they are about to have young, or when they bring their offspring into the world, it's their very nature to be defensive of them. And I'm going to illustrate that in many ways this morning. When you begin to read about females that are allowing things to be done to their young before they were born in the world, when you read in the world, read about people that are taking their offspring, putting them in garbage cans, burning them with cigarettes, beating, abusing them, and I don't like to get too graphic about this. I try to bear in mind I'm preaching to mixed audiences and a lot of tender ears, but you say, well, you shouldn't be mentioning this in the pulpit. Well, go home, turn off your TV. Don't let your kids watch TV. It's all in the newspapers. It's everywhere. Things like I'm describing here, abusing children, abandoning children, turning them over to other folk to bring up, and not to mention things they allow being done to them before they're ever born, that is done by people without natural affection. Because according to nature, when a female is bearing young or delivers young into the world, they become very defensive of their young. Back when my wife and I met, she's probably the most naive, innocent, Pollyanna type of person you could imagine. My wife back then had no desire to hurt anybody's feelings, much less to hurt anybody physically. And back in those days, my roguish little brothers called her Sarah Goodheart. Just so sweet, very naive, very Pollyanna, horrified at the idea of hurting anybody's feelings, much less hurting them physically. But she told me over and over, when she gave birth to little David, and they came and placed this little baby boy in her arms for the first time, as she began to look down at him, she said she had feelings that she had never had before in her life. She said all of a sudden a feeling arose in her that for the first time in my life, I'm capable of killing somebody if I had to, if they tried to hurt him. First time in my life, I feel like I could hurt somebody, I could even kill somebody if they tried to hurt him. You know all that's happening here? God was turning on that switch that is natural in females of all kinds. In my lifetime, I remember back when I was about 8 years of old, 8 years of age, living in a ranch country of southern Oklahoma. I had about the age of my youngest grandson, Justin. There was a mare over here, mama horse to you city folk, that had just given birth to a colt. And a colt to you city folk, that's a baby horse. This little colt just came into the world. This little colt was interested in what the little colt was seeing in this world. And I was at a barbed wire fence, and I was very fascinated by the little colt. And the little colt was very fascinated by me. And I stood there staring at this little colt for a long time. Up came the mama mare. And looking back with my 20/20 hindsight, I understand some things today that an 8-year-old boy did not. That mama mare gave me a few snorts, and she was looking at me with the evil eye and snorting at me, and I understand very well now she was telling me, "You're too interested in my baby, you better get away." I didn't get away. Finally, that mama mare lunged at me like a snake, and her upper teeth caught me right here and raked back some skin. If she had gotten me with both teeth, I probably wouldn't have a chin today, or probably had a lot of repair work to do on it. Back when I was a youngster, living in a ranch country, southern Oklahoma, we always had hens. And we didn't have them for a hobby. We had a big garden, didn't have hens. It was not a hobby. It was a long way to the county seat over in Marietta, Oklahoma. People back in that day didn't go to town except on Saturday. And besides, back in those days, they were rationing gas anyway. And gardens and killing hogs and hens and stuff like that were not a hobby. That was where we received most of what we ate. Back in those days, we always had hens. And my mother put me through all stages of going into the chicken yard. And I won't get into too many details of capturing a hen and going through all stages of dressing it. And if I were to describe that to you, you'd probably say I was really undressing the hen and cutting it up and all that. I was trained to do all that. But also, we gathered the eggs that the hens laid, and sometimes they would sit on the eggs to hatch them. You say a sitting hen? Oh, no, setting hen. I mean, although they were sitting, I never in my life ever heard them called a sitting hen. They were a setting hen. And sometimes I'd be very fascinated by these setting hens, because after a while, little chickies would come into the world, and it'd be peep, 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 like so. But I have a vivid memory one time coming up on a setting hen, and I got a little bit too curious about what was going on, and that mama hen flies out of the nest and flogged me. Another time in my life, a good bit later, when I was very young and quick, my son David was raising hogs. He also had chickens and had hens, but my son David was raising hogs, and there was one particular sow that I'd fed. I'd done all kinds of things to this sow, had no reason to be any afraid of this sow. But there came a day when David's off at school. I go down to the pen. The little sow, big sow actually, was delivering her piggies. And one of those piggies had got over into a mesh wire fence and had its little head hung in it. So I climbed over into the pig pen. I had no reason to be afraid of this sow. I'd done all kinds of things around this sow. And I opened the mesh wire, got the little piggy's head out of the mesh wire, trying to do a good deed. But remember, my good deeds seldom go unpunished. About the time that I got the little piggy free and set the piggy on the ground, the piggy squealed. Mama sow rises up. She comes charging at me with her mouth wide open like that. Thank the good Lord, I was very young and limber back then. I grabbed top of a fence post, a pole vaulted over, just ahead of her hot breath. That sow had done declared non-fellowship for me. The idea of Hard Shell Baptist declaring non-fellowship for me has never bothered me 30 seconds in my life. It might scare some preachers. Never bothered me 30 seconds. But the idea of a sow with their mouth wide open declaring non-fellowship for me, going to take a hunk out of my leg, that's a serious matter. Okay, so a lot of you folk know that night of December 6th, about 2006, I went down in the dark to try to help about a 1,000-pound Brangus cow who was down with a calf. And, well, I never added all this up before, but I've been bitten by a mama horse. I've been flogged by a mama hen. I've been charged by a mama pig, and I've been beaten around by a mama cow. So you'd think by now I ought to be getting very paranoid about females with babies. You'd think a man with any sense would finally learn his lesson after about four accounts. I've told you all this morning that out here in nature, wherever you find it, it's a nature God puts in females of all kinds to be defenders of their offspring. I could tell you about some times when I was a youngster growing up, I probably wouldn't be alive today if my mother hadn't come to my defense when I didn't know that I didn't have any more sense than get in danger. There's times my mother came to my rescue. I could tell you of accounts I've known where strong men who could swim were in the water trying to rescue a child out there drowning in the water, and mothers who couldn't swim a lick, they were having to restrain them from diving in the water trying to get them. I could tell you accounts I know where strong men were trying to restrain mothers from going into burning buildings when there's emergency people in there trying to rescue children. It's the very nature of females to be defenders of their young. In fact, I got to tell you another quick one. When my daughter Lynn began to bring her little bundles of joy into the world, sometimes she'd bring them up the farm or I'd somewhere else. Up she comes with her little bundles of joy, especially Caitlin and Claire, the first ones. I would go out eager to grab hold of them. But before my daughter Lynn would allow me to have her babies, with one hand she's holding them back like this, with the other hand she is pulling the toothpick out of my mouth, stripping me of my tire gauges over here, my carpenter pencils, my glasses, anything I had up here might injure the little darlings. I've been through the, Lynn put me through the strip more than once. Toothpick got to go, Dad. This got to go. I mean, she cleaned me up before she'd ever hand me those little bundles of joy. A little bit later, when they became grabbits, she wouldn't hand them to me. She had reached up and taken my glasses off. Now then, I've told you all that this morning. The Bible tells over here there come a time when people would be without natural affection. I insist that a lot that I see and hear about in this world today falls under that category. When I read some of the things, or hear about some of the things I've named earlier, about mothers abandoning, abusing, going off and leaving them, all these type of things I've named, that's people without natural affection. As I read in the Bible about other defenders, I'm going to come to Ecclesiastes chapter 7, about verse 12, and Solomon makes some strange statements over here about defenders. Solomon tells us over here, he said, money is a defense, and wisdom is a defense. But he says the excellency of knowledge is, and he's going to tell you here, wisdom and knowledge is actually a better defense than money. The excellency of knowledge is that it giveth life unto them that have it. Now, I think you folk out here have read the Bible long enough that sometimes that word life in the Bible, it means vital life, the ability to breathe and be alive, where a paramedic would say you're alive, in opposition to being dead. Sometimes it means vital life. Other places, though, the word life in the Bible does not mean vital life in the sense of being a paramedic pronouncing you living or dead, but sometimes that word life in the Bible has reference to the appreciation of life and the enjoyment of life. For instance, we come to 1 Timothy chapter 5, and the apostle's given instructions over here about widows that the church is to honor, widows that are widows indeed. But by contrast, he mentions this widow that does not live according to the gospel and the way a godly church member where to ought to live, and he begins to discuss this widow that just decides to go out here and live in pleasure. And about 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 8, he said, "She that liveth in pleasure is dead while she liveth." Well, that sentence sounds ridiculous to a lot of people. But what the Apostle Paul is saying, that some widow over here in the church, husband dies, and she just decides she'll get out and live according to the world and all that. She's physically alive. Any doctor would pronounce her alive. Maybe she's in good health. But if she keeps living that way, she's going to die to the enjoyment of her spiritual life and die to the joys of gospel obedience. And some of you Bible readers probably thinking right now that that sounds like Luke chapter 15 and the lesson of the prodigal son. When this prodigal son wanders away and then comes back home, the father says twice in verse 24 and also again verse 32, he says, "Rejoice with me, for this my son which was dead is alive again." That boy had never been bodily or physically dead. But that boy had wandered away and he had died to his place of honor at the family table. He had died to the fellowship. And I'll put it this way, he had died to the enjoyment and the appreciation of the life that he had. Now we go back to the text. Solomon says, money is a defense and wisdom is a defense, but the excellency of knowledge is that it giveth life unto them that have it. That expression there, giveth life, is not speaking about giving life like when you were conceived or like when you're born of the Spirit. But it has reference, though, to the enjoyment and appreciation of life. Knowledge, especially spiritual knowledge, gives you the appreciation and the enjoyment of the life you already have. But let's look at that first statement. Solomon says, money is a defense. How is money a defense? In my lifetime, money has been one of the most mysterious subjects I've ever tried to think about. You say, well, what's mysterious about money? Oh, a lot of things are mysterious to me about money. One of the things that's mysterious to me about money is that the deficiency of it or the lack of it brings on all kinds of worries and problems. And you folk might understand that unless you were born with a silver spoon in your mouth and never ran short on the stuff. But I'm sure there's a few people in this congregation have some idea what I'm talking about. The lack of it brings on all kinds of problems, brings on all kinds of worries, the lack of it. But on the other hand, the presence of it or having a good stock of it or somebody hands you a bundle of it, it does not guarantee happiness because sometimes it just brings on another set of problems. Now, the reason that's mysterious to me is because in nature, if you're lacking in a certain vitamin or a mineral, or you're lacking in low in blood sugar, or there's something over here you're lacking, usually the supply of it corrects the problem. Okay, so here we have folk out here that, like my wife and I, when we first started out in life, trying to keep the wolf away from the door, and sometimes the old wolf had pups, and So I've told a lot of folk my financial statement's very easy to read. My wife and I started out life with nothing and managed to keep most of it through very good managing. But back in those days, the lack of it brought on all kinds of worries and concerns and things like that. And a lot of you folk here know what I'm talking about. But on the other hand, when the Lord's good enough to supply these things, it is not guaranteed happiness. Example over here in Luke chapter 12, the Lord tells us over here that the ground of a certain rich man brought forth plentifully. This man is rich before he ever put a plow on the ground. Now he's making another bumper crop. You say, well, that ought to make him very happy. No, it doesn't. It gives him more problems. Ground of a certain rich man went brought forth plentifully, and he said, my barns, my granaries, my cribs are full already. He said, what am I going to do with all that? And I could see him in his mind. He goes to bed designing build bigger barns and bigger cribs to store it. And the Lord appears to, the Lord says to him that night, thou fool. He said, This night shall thy soul be required of thee. In other words, you're going to die. And where are all these goods going? And in this day and age, I've been around quite a few people who have plenty. And sometimes the main thing they want to talk to me about is, where's the best place to put it? A lot of folk today don't feel secure putting it in the banks. And I don't want to talk at length about that. I don't like to worry folk too much. I don't like to talk too much about our financial system, which is just a house of cards. A lot of folk don't have confidence in here and there and all that. So people who have it, they're concerned about the best place to put it and really can't sleep well after they put it there. Okay, very well. This says money is a defense. Somebody says, I preach about money. Oh, you like to hear sheep stories and sheep illustrations? Would you rather hear them? The Lord Jesus Christ used more money illustrations in his parables than anything else. Try it out. Lord Jesus Christ taught more lessons about good stewardship, managing your talents, than all anything else. One of the greatest blessings that parents can pass on to their children is to set a good example and teach youngsters management of money and to live within their means. Living within their means. I find over here in Proverbs chapter 22 where Solomon warns, and he said, be not of them that strike hands or that are sureties for debts. Now, in this day and age, usually a deal is you sign on the bottom line. Usually you sign on the dotted line to complete a loan or a deal of some kind. For many years on this earth, such a transaction was sealed with a handshake. He said, be not of them that strike hands. Don't be eager to strike hands with somebody that's going to loan you money. Don't be eager to strike hands and agree to go into debt. And he says, be not thou one of them that's eager to strike hands. To you today, that means sign on the dotted line. Or them that are sureties for debts. That is, don't jump at the chance to be somebody's co-signer, their backup. Because Solomon says, if thou hast nothing to pay, why should he remove thy bed from beneath thee? I think you've got this figured out. Jump into debt too fast. And here come the foreclosures, and here come the repossessors. They're ready to yank it out from under you. I've told a story many times of a wealthy fella carrying his poor, taking his poor friend through his fine home. He said, my furniture's very expensive. It goes all the way back to Louis XIV. Fella said, that reminds me, mine goes back to Sears the 15th. Okay, you'll catch it in a minute. Look at this. You find in the Bible has a lot to say about debt. And American people today are drowning in it. And I'm not saying this to throw rocks at young people that have fallen into this credit trap. I was in Virginia back in July. I spent several days with a friend of mine about my age. Started out in life with nothing, but he's well known as being a very wise man and a very successful businessman and has about as much wisdom as any Primitive Baptist deacon I've ever met. And he was visiting with me about something I'm hearing more and more about all over this country. There are a lot of people in my age group. I heard about 8 or 9 cases of it while I was in North Carolina and Virginia. There are a lot of people in my age group that are having 35 and 40 and 45-year-old children having to move back in with their parents for the simple reason they stuck their necks out on homes they can't pay for. They went too far in debt, and their jobs are being outsourced, offshored. There's been downsizing, all this type of thing, and there's nothing to do but go back home and live with mom and dad until maybe they can get back on their feet. This, I don't mean to be scaring a lot of you gray-haired parents out there, and maybe it'll never happen to you. This friend of mine, I've already said, very wise man, very good businessman. He said to me, he said, Brother Powell, said, you and I remember a day when if you went over to town to borrow money, It was understood there was something back home on the farm that you could use to bail yourself out if the crop failed, or in other words, you go over to town to borrow money, and suppose your plans don't work out, crop fails, something happens, and the note becomes due. Said you didn't go to town and borrow that money unless you had something back home on the farm. You had some cows you didn't really want to sell, but you could sell them. You had some equipment back there that you didn't really want to get rid of. But in other words, you had some collateral back home that you could sell out if you had to, if you failed on that debt. Yes, I remember a friend of mine in Dallas ran a big repair shop, and there were times he'd go borrow money, but he knew good and well he had battery chargers, jacks, a lot of stuff like that. In fact, I knew this fellow one time had sell that, a lot of that stuff, to pay off a note and start all over again with his hand tools. There was a time when people didn't borrow money unless in a showdown they had a couple of milk cows or an acre of land or something they could sell to bail themselves out. I want to add something to it. There was a time when lenders were your friend. They probably wouldn't loan that money if they felt like you didn't have a way out of it. There was a time when you'd go down and visit the old fish-eyed banker. You say, what does that mean? That's that look they give you when you go in and ask them for a big loan. You say, I don't know what you're talking about. Go ask for a big loan. Watch the eye glaze over. Kind of like a dead fish. You'll find I've accurately described them. There was a time when you went and see the old fish-eyed banker. And the old fish-eyed banker thought it over, and if the fish-eyed banker didn't really think it was a good investment, then you probably wouldn't get out of it, they would tell you. Then we went into a period in America where nothing down, or little down, usually nothing down, and lured into this credit trap. And there's a lot of people in America today skating on thin ice, a lot of people losing sleep over it, and it's a situation I pray to God will get better, but it could very well get a lot worse. I want to go back and recount an experience I had just a few weeks ago. In fact, it was 3 weeks ago today on Saturday. And I think most of you people understand one reason I'm not here at the ordinary time. Same schedule, just 3 weeks later. I tried to thank the church here for it the first night I got up. But my oldest granddaughter and Brother Dan Beecham, that a lot of you know, fine Primitive Baptist young man, they thought and thought and tried to set their wedding where it'd be convenient for most people. I've said David and I have decided we were not most people. They set it on a date that I'd ordinarily be preaching here for you, and I appreciate you bailing me out on this. Also, David put on his clothes in Siberia, didn't take them off for 36 hours, went through 14 time zones, landed in Memphis, Tennessee, 8 o'clock on a Thursday night, got home to Mississippi midnight, couldn't sleep because of jet lag and all of this, had to drive about 5.5-6 hours to Tyler, Texas for a wedding rehearsal, and went through the whole thing on autopilot with his eyes glazed over. So apparently we weren't included in the most people because it wasn't the most convenient time for him or for me. But anyway, at that wedding, my granddaughter's wedding, about 3 weeks ago today, my granddaughter and arranging the wedding. First of all, remembered her mother's wedding, my daughter. And my daughter back then told me she absolutely could not bear the idea of me being up here one place and her poor mama back there in another place. She wanted us together. So my daughter's arrangement, her wedding, she wanted sweet David, her brother, who was single back then, to perform the wedding. My job was to march my daughter down the aisle and then offer a prayer and go back and sit with Mama, and this would solve everybody's problem. So now comes time for my granddaughter's wedding. What my granddaughter wants is, here's Uncle David going to do a lot of the part up here. There's other people had a part in it, but I'll get to what she wanted me to do. First of all, my daughter made a lot of unusual requests for that wedding. Maybe Brother Dan Beecham, maybe so, but Elder Jody Wild, who was there, who was at my home church the next morning, commented when he got up to speak that it was probably the most spiritually oriented wedding that he ever attended. And I'd have to say so. It was not put on to be a great big production. There was a spiritual theme all through it. First of all, my daughter thought it was rather silly for her little brother Justin to come down the ring bearer with the two rings on a pillow. Instead, she requested that we get Dado's old pocket Bible, the one back here that's got hundreds of thousands of miles on it, my preaching Bible, and they want to take my preaching Bible, which they did, and they tied both rings on my preaching Bible with ribbons, one this way, that way, the other in the form of a cross, and my grandson comes down now bearing those rings on Dado's old preaching Bible, because my granddaughter said that's what this family's all about. She said that's what's made all this possible. Well, I can show you a few ways, but I'm not going to labor that. Because of Primitive Baptist connections, that's how she met Brother Dan Beecham, fine Primitive Baptist young man. And I could tell you a lot of other things she said about, of course, felt like the whole family's life had revolved around my preaching. And, of course, that was very touching to me. But my job was to come up here to the altar, and they told me to either stand or kneel. I chose to kneel and offer prayer, and then go back and sit with grandmother. I'm going to give you a few things I prayed for, and I'm going to come to something in that prayer that I'm going to beg you, do not react to it. Do not react to it the way you're inclined to react to it. Solomon said in Proverbs 18:13, he that answereth a matter before he heareth it, it's a shame and folly to him. I'm going to come to something in that prayer that I prayed for that you're probably going to go off track. Because if somebody were to tell me about it, I'm not saying you're dumb, if somebody were to tell me about it, I'd probably go off track. Okay, I came up to, I knelt down beside my granddaughter, and one of the things I prayed for is that we and all of us and them would always remember that marriage is not an institution of this sin-cursed earth under the curse of sin, but that marriage had its origin in Eden in a paradise before sin ever marred this earth. That's very good to remember. Marriage is not conducted under the laws of Tennessee or Texas or the United States of America. It did not originate in a world under the curse of sin. It originated back at a paradise before sin ever entered into the world. I also praise that they could always remember that marriage, that the home is the first divine institution God ever placed on this earth. You know why that's important? While I honor the church, and I try to honor the ministry, I also recognize the church is the first, the home is the first divine institution God ever put here. And Satan has never been able to do the church a complete damage or demolish it by directly attacking the church. But Satan's very subtle. Satan chooses to attack the home. And Satan, by attacking the home like he has for many, many years, produces a lot of people that are so disheveled and disoriented and confused and discouraged that many times they don't pay much attention to the church. Their lives are scrambled because he attacks the home. I've also tried to tell quite a few preachers in my lifetime who seem to think there's a verse over in Matthew 6:32 where the Lord says, seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. It's the nature of most preachers to read that this way, seek ye only the kingdom of God. Lord didn't say seek ye only, he said seek it first. I have known a few preachers in my life, including a few who have destroyed their bodies and their minds by believing that they were supposed to be gospel preachers 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days out of the year. That tells me I'm to seek first the kingdom of God. That tells me I have seconds in my life. I've got a wife. I've got a family. I have a responsibility to my community. I also have grass to cut and oil to change in my car and a lot of the same things you people have to do. I leave that way. That verse is, okay, now, whenever I'm involved in second, thirds, and fourths, if a need arises in the kingdom of God, I'm willing to drop those things and seek first the kingdom of God. I've met preachers that thought it was a sin if they ever took their families off somewhere and had a vacation or godly relaxation or made a garden or went fishing. That text does not say seek ye only. It says seek ye first. Okay, very well, at that point. While I recognize, I hope, the importance of the ministry, and I hope I have proved it, I also have a responsibility to my home. You understand that? I've got a responsibility to my wife of 51 years. I have a responsibility to my children. I am very adamant when I say the home is the first divine institution God ever put on this earth. And no preacher should ever forget that. Sometimes preachers get so heavily minded, they're no earthly good. In that prayer, I tried to pray that they'd always remember the home is the first divine institution on this earth. I also, in that prayer, prayed that their hearts would forever remain tender toward each other, because we come to Matthew chapter 19, and when they confronted the Lord with the divorce controversy that's going around in that day, the Lord reminded them that God joined Adam and Eve together, and he said, what God has joined together, let not man put asunder. At first, God made no provision for that marriage ever separating, other than in death. But he says there that later that the Lord suffered Moses because of the hardness of your heart to write a bill of divorcement. God made no provision for divorce at the first. You find later that God suffered Moses to allow them to write a bill of divorcement. But right here in this statement, the Lord gives the root cause of I'd say every divorce, most everyone I can think of. He said Moses allowed that because of the hardness of your hearts. You say, well, what about if somebody becomes an adulterer, fornicator? somebody's heart got hardened. Because you have a couple before you here, their hearts are tender toward each other. Before somebody's going to do some of these things you're thinking about, somebody's heart's got to get hard toward that other person. You say, well, what about a wife beater? What about this type of thing? Somebody's heart's got to get hardened. As long as I try to maintain a tender heart toward my wife of over 51 years, and she maintains a tender heart toward me, we're going to stay together. I insist somebody's heart had to get hardened. Okay, now here's the part that I'm going to ask you, hang on before you react. Because I promise you, if you give a knee-jerk, jack-in-the-box reaction, you're going off track. Also in that prayer, I closed out by saying, Lord, cause them to always remember seven words of grandfatherly counsel, which are taught in thy word, and I've also learned in life's bitter school of experience. Those seven words are, fear God and stay out of debt. I was bowed down in the midst of at a prayer. That building at Tyler, Texas was filled with people, and I'll promise you it'd been filled if all the folk on the stage had been out there trying to get seats. When I prayed that God would cause them to always remember seven words of grandfatherly counsel, which are taught in thy word, and which I have also learned in the bitter school of life's experience, and those seven words are, fear God and stay out of debt, there was a ripple of laughter and chuckling went all over that audience during the prayer. But lest you go off track and say how awful, you know, how out of place. I had person after person come up and tell me, lots of people. Brother Piles, I didn't laugh out of ridicule. I didn't laugh because I thought that's funny. I had a lot of young people come up and tell me, I wish somebody preached that to us. It's a little late for us. You know, we're trying to get out. I wish somebody to said that to us. I had one preacher, young, I call him young preacher, but he'd been preaching probably 5 or 10 years. He said, I chuckled out at that because he said, only you would have the brass and the audacity to say something like that. But he said, I'm dealing all the time with friends that their marriages are in a strain and they're having trouble because they're drowning in debt. And he said, I wish I had the backbone to say that to people. There's a lot of gray-haired people came up to me. My sister, for one, 2 years younger than me, she came up to me and she said, you know, back when we married, we didn't have any choice, right? Didn't have all this easy credit. No, my wife and I had no choice. My sister and her husband had no choice. We had to live within our means and we had to stay out of debt and gradually accumulate things. She said, we didn't have any choice. She said, I'm very thankful that the younger folk in my family got to hear that. There's a lot of older people came up, and they all told me, said, I didn't laugh out because of ridicule or because I thought it's funny. Some of them said, I couldn't believe so much wisdom packed into 7 words. Some folk even said, well, it just sounds like something only you would say. Well, I'll leave that with you. Some folk came up and told me, said, well, two preachers that are up there said a lot of words that day, and they were all good words, and that's right. The two preachers took part in that wedding and said a lot of good words. But a lot of folk told me, said, I'm afraid the only words that's going to survive and be remembered, you know, long term, is fear God and stay out of debt. Managing money and wisdom about living within your means is a defense. And I hope you know it, or you're going to find it out. He also says here, wisdom is a defense. And I'm going to give you a quick example, of wisdom being a defense. One of the very best things you folk out here with youngsters, or some of you out here planning to have families, some of you already have children, some of you may be going to have them. And if you're a sincere parent, you got your head screwed on right, you recognize that there's all kinds of entrapments out there waiting on your children. There's entrapments out there of every kind, influences of every kind. Behind that TV switch, there's all kinds of pitfalls. Behind those buttons on your computer, all kinds of trouble. Out here in the public schools, out here everywhere, there's all kinds of pitfalls your children can fall into. And you can keep them home for a while, try to shield them. And a lot of noble people among our folk have chosen to homeschool them, and I may say some more about that later, and it's not going to be an assault on your public schools, and it's not going to be a blank check for everybody to do it because it's not for everybody. I appreciate the concern a lot of people have today, a lot of young people among Primitive Baptists have for their children. But one of the best defenses you can give them is to teach them the Bible. Try to impart to them some Bible wisdom. Then bring them here to the house of God every time you can and pray to God. You've got a good Bible-teaching preacher up here in the pulpit that will try to impart some Bible wisdom to them. Because that Bible wisdom is a defense against the pitfalls of this world. And I'll give you one quick example and try to make it short as I can. My oldest granddaughter, the one that I've told you about her wedding, enrolled at the University of Texas at Dallas to start her freshman year. And out there in that school, and I don't figure it's any worse than a lot of the others, out there at that school, she began to hear words she had never heard before. She begins to hear things discussed that had never heard before. And some of you are saying, oh, well, since she's homeschooled all the way through, it was a violent reaction. She couldn't handle it. You couldn't be any more wrong. Couldn't be a bit more wrong. She handled it very well. That's another phony baloney argument that's made against homeschooling. You know, they're so sheltered from everything. They're not as sheltered as you think. My daughter and son-in-law have a TV. My daughter and son-in-law have a computer, remember? And they play with the neighborhood kids. And they say, well, they need social interaction. My grandchildren had plenty of it. All their time growing up, they've been taken to Primitive Baptist churches, been taken to Primitive Baptist meetings, Pigeon Forge and all over the country. And they've got hundreds of friends. They've had worlds of social interaction. Okay, very well. Granddaughter goes out there and begins to hear things discussed she'd never heard before, begins to hear words she'd never heard before. And once upon a time, she had stayed up late in the night, frying her brain, trying to get ready for a high-tension test. She had taken the test, passed it, finished her first year with a 4-point average. Meant she's walking down the hall of this college, running on autopilot. Here's a lounge area over here with some couches and chairs. So she flops back in one of them and crashes out and goes to sleep. When she woke up, there were 5 other students around her. They were talking, but they were not talking to her. They were talking to each other. She is just sort of laid back, as we used to say, playing possum. All 5 of those children, all 5 of them were talking about how they hated their parents. My granddaughter lay there, and she began to think, yes, you hate those parents that bought those expensive clothes you're wearing. You hate those parents that bought those expensive automobiles out in the parking lot that make it possible for you to go to this expensive college. And she recognized that this was totally wrong. You know why? Because her parents had imparted to her all kinds of godly wisdom about that particular matter. Here you have an allegedly sheltered homeschooler that gets out here in the jungle and handles it very well, and handled it very well all year. You know why? Because her parents had imparted to her the wisdom that it takes for a defense. He said, and I'm going to say one more thing right fast. I've said to congregations for many, many years that if you'll send your children off to school, or they've got to leave home, and they're well anchored one side on the Genesis account of the creation, and they're anchored on the other side about the worldwide flood in the days of Noah and the changes that made on this earth. If they're anchored in those things, it's very unlikely Dr. Smellfungus is going to pull them loose up here at a brain laundry commonly called a college. I know that by experience because many Primitive Baptist youngsters over this country that I've stood before them and I have pounded into them the Genesis account of creation, that there's a far better Bible argument for that than there is in this other nonsense. I've also I preached to them that a lot of these changes in the earth, which they claim took place millions of years, that those things took place in a very short time during the Genesis flood. And I could give you a bunch of books I'd recommend you might read, but I won't sidetrack here. I've never known one of those Primitive Baptist youngsters that I had the privilege of trying to anchor in those two things that ever went off to a brain laundry and got swept away. Wisdom, especially spiritual wisdom, is a defense. I've got to close out here somewhere. But we have some other things here that are worth defending. I come over here to first, I want Philippians chapter 1. I'm going to look at verse 7 and verses 17. And someone maybe say, well, running a little overtime. Well, give me about 5 more minutes. I have a few more pearls to cast. You might say, you just called all of us a bunch of swine. No, I'm not calling you a swine, because if you're sitting out there listening to what I'm saying and appreciating it, I couldn't be talking about you, could I? So since all of you out here are listening intently and appreciating this, it couldn't be you I'm talking about. I got to be talking about somebody else, right? And if you're not out there listening and not appreciating this, and you get offended by what I just said, then I'm going to know you're one of the swine, but I can tell none of you are swine. You're all listening, aren't you? And you're all appreciating it. But to any swine that might happen to be in the building, give me 5 more minutes or so. I've got a few more pearls to cast. Now that you're all satisfied, couldn't be you I'm talking about. Let's proceed. I find in these verses I just cited, Philippians 1:7, Philippians 1:17, the Apostle Paul writes over here to God's people, he said, in the defense and confirmation of the gospel, you're partakers of my grace. He also tells them in that next verse that God's people over here can feel secure. Why? Knowing that I am set for the defense of the gospel. Now, it takes no knowledge about something to have a belief about it. I would say it takes very little knowledge about something to have a belief about it, but I'm going to say it takes no knowledge of something to have a belief about it. I can start mentioning a bunch of things right now, and maybe you don't know anything about them, but you probably have some kind of a belief about them instantly. Okay, let's take up going out here with a divining rod or a limb and doing what's called water witching or dowsing for water. You believe something about that. Maybe you don't know the first thing about it. Some of you are saying, maybe saying, oh, that's just witchcraft, a bunch of nonsense. Somebody else is saying, I've seen it done, I believe in it. Somebody else is saying, well, if it works, it works because of some scientific law we don't understand yet. You believe something about it. Okay, wearing a copper bracelet around your wrist to ward off arthritis, gout, or rheumatism. You may not know anything about that. Maybe you never heard of it. I've heard of it all for time and time again. You believe something about that. You either believe it's nonsense, superstition, or what? Okay, flying saucers. You believe something about it. Maybe you don't know the first thing about it. So, how many times in life has somebody come up and told you something you didn't know anything about, and you say, I don't believe that? Okay, it takes no knowledge about something to have a belief about it. God does not call gospel preachers to stand up here and flap our wings and jump up and down and say, I believe, I believe, I believe, I believe. Okay. It takes more knowledge of something to be able to explain it. Now, perhaps I might be able to get in some vehicle out here and follow my nose and get back to Elder Lawrence's home. Please do not ask me to do the driving home, Brother Ronald. Don't take me up on this. I'll probably be a little tired this afternoon. But I do believe if I had to, I could probably leave here and follow my nose and find my way back to Elder Lawrence's home. I do not understand how to get back to his home clearly enough to be able to draw it off for you and mark the streets and the numbers and all this. I'm this way by a lot of places, because there's a lot of places I've been in my life. I've gone around those places as a passenger, not a driver. And like most of you folks, I pay more attention when I'm driving than I do when I'm riding. And I can tell by the looks on your guilty faces, you know what I'm talking about. I don't pay all that much attention as a passenger. Okay, very well. I believe I could get back to Brother Lawrence's home if I had to. I'm confident I don't understand it enough to be able to tell you how to get there. It takes more knowledge to be able to explain something than it does to just believe it. It takes far more knowledge to be able to defend something. Now, by defend something, I mean this. I mean to not only explain it, but to be able to answer objections people might raise up against it. No gospel preacher is through with your studying until you're set for the defense of the gospel. And I don't mean a public debate. That might be necessary. I mean to be able to, folks, raise up objections. There's a lot of you folk out here need to be set for the defense of the gospel, because 1 Peter 3:15 says, but sanctify the Lord God in your hearts, and be ready always to give an answer to every man that asketh you a reason for the hope that's within you. Now, that doesn't mean you need to win a public debate. It does mean you ought to be able to preach a sermon, but that means everybody out here that loves the truth. You ought to be able to give a neighbor, a friend, a fellow worker, somebody that asks you, you ought to be able to give them at least one reason. You catch that? We have something we're supposed to defend in this life. I'm not ashamed of the doctrine the Primitive Baptists have always believed. I'm talking about the historic Old Baptist. I'm not ashamed of it. And I've told many people, if I'm wrong today, I started out wrong. At least I can die pleading consistency. I'm not willing to surrender the things we practiced. And as I said the first night, and I'm not going to go back and preach that sermon, I'll try to. When the children of Israel were taken across the Jordan, God told them to put memorial stones in the midst of the Jordan, and they were told to put memorial stones at the first place where they encamped for the night, Gilgal. And they were also told that when the day comes, your children ask you, what mean ye by these stones? You'd explain it to them and go back and tell them what God did. I mentioned, you'll find that expression also in Exodus 12:26 about the Passover. And when your children ask you, what mean ye by this service? Here we have the Lord's concern for the following generation. I said repeatedly the first night I preached here, unless a person has these things explained and taught, that just looks like a pile of rocks. That's all it looks like. And to the next generation, the generation after, it's going to just be a pile of rocks. There's a lot of things I believe, and I hope you believe, and a lot of things we practice, and a lot of things I stand on, that they're worthy of not only believing, because they're the truth, they're worthy of being explained, and they're worthy of being defended. And if we don't defend these things, there'll come a day right down the line, what a lot of your young people, and I'm hearing some rumblings of this, we'll start objecting to the statement that Jesus put a true church here. They'll be willing to take any kind of baptism and everybody's baptism, and they'll be willing to use grape juice and crackers in the communion. They'll be willing to do all kinds of things, compromising with the world, unless we show a willingness and a determination to defend the things I'm talking about. As I got to stop somewhere, All kinds of people concerned about the upcoming election. I'm not going to politic. I'm not supposed to do that. All I've got to say is that I'm not leaning on one candidate or the other. I think America's too far gone for that. We only have one real source to look to defend this country and guide us through the storm ahead. That's God in heaven. And I'm thankful, far as I know, that Madeleine Murray O'Hara and ACLU and all the mushheads in America have not yet been able to take off of our money in God We Trust. If they have, I haven't checked mine this morning. Only place we have to turn today for the defense of America and really the defense of the church and everything is God Himself. One last text. 33rd Psalm. Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord and the people whom He hath chosen for His own inheritance. I think if you very, very good attention, I don't charge overtime, couldn't collect it for dead, and I hope you're not too hungry. And if you're hungry, I'm even more hungry than you all. God bless you.